is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. To reopen or not to reopen? That is the question plaguing school districts around the country as they grapple with how to teach kids this fall. It's still early, but already we've seen what can happen when plans go awry. A high school in Elwood, Indiana, was forced to close its doors the same week they reopened after a student tested positive for COVID-19 on the first day of school. And last week, a high school in Georgia made headlines after a picture of maskless students packed in a hallway went viral. At least 9 people have tested positive for COVID-19 from that school. But the question remains, what is the best way to teach students in the middle of a pandemic? We asked you for your thoughts.
Hi, my name is Adrienne. I'm actually really excited for my daughter to go back to preschool. She's been back for a week now at summer camp. I honestly feel like she's safer at school than at friends' houses.
This is Ken. I teach in Fairfax County, Virginia, and I'm very grateful that the leadership in the Fairfax County Public Schools have decided to start our school year virtually for the first 9 weeks. I know that many of the students and the parents would like to have the children back in school, and so would the teachers. But as we've seen through examples throughout the country already, it's just not safe yet.
Hi, this is Kelly from Charlotte, North Carolina. Our school district is giving us a choice of a hybrid approach, whether it be one day of instruction and the rest of the week will be remote. And as a parent with a child with ADHD, I don't know what option is best for my child. And I don't know if she's going to keep her face mask on. I don't know if she's going to keep her hands to herself.
Adrienne, Ken, Kelly, thanks for leaving us those voicemails. Here to help us get closer to the answer is Sarah Darville, national editor of Chalkbeat. That's a nonprofit news organization focused on education. Sarah, welcome to 1A.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us, Superintendent P.J. Capozzi, who oversees Meridian 223. That's a school district in Stillman Valley in northern Illinois. Superintendent Capozzi, welcome.
Thank you. Honored to be here.
And Dr. Lee Beers, President-elect of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Beers, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So, Sarah, school is starting up soon. In some cases, it's already started. Can you give us a national picture of how school districts around the country are reopening?
Yeah. It's really, only a small group of school districts have opened already, but obviously everyone is getting ready in some form. And what that looks like is pretty different. Obviously, most of the country's biggest school districts have said, you know what, we're not ready to reopen. And they are making plans to teach students remotely for at least several weeks, sometimes several months. In other places, there are, hybrid options. One of our reporters was recently in Rockford, Illinois, where elementary school students will be going back 5 days a week, but older students only a couple days a week. And then we saw, we've seen some schools like the school you mentioned in Georgia, where the, students are all back and there, and we're trying to figure out what that means.
Dr. Beers, from a health standpoint, is it safe for kids to return to school in person?
Oh, well, thank you for that. It's a great question. And I think one of the most important things that we have to remember is that it really depends on your level of community spread. We absolutely feel like it's best for kids to be getting in-person learning, but we really have to take into account community spread, and schools have to be thinking about that as they make their decisions. I think in general, we know that particularly younger kids are less likely to get severely ill with COVID-19, and they're less likely to spread the illness. But again, that can be highly variable on community spread as to what the impact is.
Well, the American Academy of Pediatrics guidance on reopening says that schools should be working toward reopening in person safely. But I think there's a lot of question around what safely actually looks like. Can you give us some guidance?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that you're exactly right. That is our recommendation. I think we know, and I think that that, you know, I think there's general agreement on this, that most children are better served through in-person learning, and some children are really poorly served by virtual learning, and perhaps even experiencing, you know, serious harms or long-term harms from that. So then the question becomes, how do we go back safely? So first and most importantly, this has to be a decision that's made in collaboration with your local public health departments that takes into account community spread. When you have lower rates of circulating virus, it's your ability to mitigate risk and go back to school is much better. It's also going to mean that our schools need more resources, right? It's not just go back in the same way that we were in last fall. You know, it's going to require cloth coverings for cloth face coverings for teachers and students. It's going to require the ability to have the cleaning supplies needed and the hand sanitizer needed, the ability to space kids out a little bit more. And so our schools are going to need additional resources to be able to come back safely.
Well, a new report from your organization shows that at least 97,000 children tested positive for coronavirus in the last 2 weeks of July alone. And the number of kids who have been infected since the pandemic began is around 338,000. So we saw this big chunk in a 2 week span at the end of July. Does that give you any additional thinking around whether or not kids should be going back to school in person?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, what it really emphasizes is the importance of controlling community spread. It really, to me, you know, we've also seen at the same time really, you know, significantly increasing rates of coronavirus across our country. And so it really emphasizes for me the importance of adults and communities doing the things that need to be done to control the community spread. It means being, you know, really, really careful about wearing your face coverings when you're out and about, staying at home as much as you can, avoiding going out and doing non-essential things that might contribute to community spread. Because the more we can control the spread of the virus in our communities, the less number of children will be infected, the less number of adults will be infected, and the more likely we are to be able to get our kids back to school safely.
Superintendent Capozzi, what's your district's plan for reopening at this point?
We have a hybrid model in place with the option for parents to select full remote learning. So every student will receive 2 face-to-face days of instruction and 3 days of remote, with special considerations for our populations that are most traditionally underserved.
Are you happy with the plan that you have at this point?
I'm really happy with the process we used to develop a plan. I think that any district that ends up with a hybrid model is shooting at the middle. And the way that I've phrased it to my staff and my community several times is that I think by October 1st, we open next week. So by October 1st, we'll have a really clear indication whether we were too conservative and should have tried to get more kids in the building each day, or whether we were too aggressive and should have started fully remote. I feel like with any hybrid plan, what you're doing is taking kind of a middle vanilla option of basically saying what everyone believes, which, and I fully firmly believe as an educator, is the best place for kids is in school with face-to-face instruction. And then the comma comes in and says, if safe. And the part that's been frustrating for me as a school leader is that I am not a health expert. And so it's very difficult for me to determine what is safe. And the guidance that we've continued to receive has been mixed and changing. And part of that's the scientific process, which is awesome to be a part of, but very frustrating when you're trying to make decisions that are going to impact thousands of people.
How much community input did you get into this plan?
As much as possible. So we surveyed our community on 3 different occasions. One was just to get a recap of what happened in the spring as to what went well and what didn't. Then we asked if people would be interested in remote instruction as the primary option. And when we did that initially, 46% of our population said they'd be very interested in that. When we asked people to commit to that, that number went down to 16%. And so we had to flip our plan kind of upside down as the public opinion on what they wanted shifted.
The debate around how schools should reopen has been a juggling act of competing interests, though some feel like the ball has been dropped when it comes to certain kids.
Hi, this is Lynn from Ohio. One of the things nobody is talking about is the group of kids who really need to have in-person schooling, and online just isn't an option for them.
We'll talk about that and more with Sarah Darville, National Editor for Chalkbeat, Dr. Lee Beers, President-elect of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and P.J. Capozzi, Superintendent of a School District in Stillman Valley in Northern Illinois. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor WNYC Studios, presenting the podcast Come Through with cultural critic Rebecca Carroll. Carroll explores the role of race in the issues the nation faces and what it all means for the 2020 elections and the nation's future. She speaks with guests about whether the burden of white fragility is often unduly placed on people of color, how the coronavirus is affecting Black communities, and if faith is enough to sustain us at this time. Come Through with Rebecca Carroll, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
Hey parents, Mindy here from Wow in the World, NPR's podcast for all ages. With schools out, we are all looking for fun ways to educate and entertain our kids. Wow in the World has over 100 science-filled, screen-free episodes to help them laugh and learn. It's like a cartoon for their brains. Wow in the World from Tinkercast and NPR.
I'm Jen White. We're discussing how schools should reopen this fall as the first part of our education series, Homeworked. All this week, we're looking at how grading is changing, how parents are turning to homeschooling in pods, and how students with disabilities are faring with remote instruction. But first, schools have to decide whether to reopen at all. We're talking about that with Sarah Darville, National Editor for Chalkbeat, Dr. Lee Beers, President-elect of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and PJ Capozzi, Superintendent of a School District in Stillman Valley in Northern Illinois. One listener messaged, "Our school district voted to move all classes online recently. I'm relieved by the decision. However, I think about children without resources such as internet or parents who can't stay home and teach them, and it really concerns me. Online instruction can be inequitable." And a member of the 1A Text Club says, "Schools should reopen in person. Too much is lost not being in the classroom, and younger people are supposed to be at less risk." Meanwhile, Karma wrote on Facebook, "Better to miss an entire year of school then sacrifice some to death or lifelong disability. We'll catch up after we're vaccinated. Opening in-person school is absurd." Sarah, talk about some of the competing interests that are at play in this debate.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things you just mentioned there, I mean, obviously schools are a place where students learn, but they're also a place where students are fed, where students receive mental and physical health support, where students receive special education services, where they socialize with friends. And, you know, what makes this dilemma so hard is that schools know better than anyone that, you know, they're in a much better position to provide those services in person. And, you know, the reality of income inequality in our country means that, you know, for many students, these aren't just nice to have. These are, you know, critical kinds of support. But schools are also trying to balance that with, you know, one, what's safe. Obviously, the testing positivity rates really vary right now. Where I'm sitting in New York, it's around 1%. But in a place like Mississippi, I think the last time I looked, it was 20, something like that. And also what's possible, you know, do you have the space and staff to social distance if that's part of your plan? Do students have a way to, you know, get internet access or access to those devices that they need to work remotely? What are state and local health authorities allowing schools to do? And then also what do parents and teachers want and what will they accept? Nationally, both groups, you know, polls and surveys have shown they're pretty wary of sending students back. But obviously, that also varies a lot by place. And we're seeing, you know, a racial and partisan divide there, too. So it's really complicated for superintendents trying to figure out the right way forward with the science changing, budgets being uncertain, and in some ways, the decision becoming more political as well.
Well, one thing this debate has done is highlighted the important role schools play in supporting parents and their students, as you said, Sarah. Let's listen.
Hi, my name is Mina. I would like to see school go back part-time in the fall, but the school district has already decided to go back virtually. And we have a lot of problems that not enough kids have technology here. Not enough kids have internet here. We've got a lot of poverty.
Hi, this is Elizabeth. I work in Poughkeepsie, New York. I myself am a healthcare worker, and so is my husband. It feels very hard to send our kids to school, but it also makes it really hard for healthcare workers to continue to do their jobs if we don't have some sort of education to send our kids to in the fall.
Mina, Elizabeth, thanks for leaving us those voicemails. Superintendent, how has this pandemic laid bare some of the inefficiencies or just some of the gaps in the public education system in your district?
I think that it just exposed inequities that probably should have been exposed long before and in more proactive districts, and I'd like to consider mine one of them that we've been trying to address. But I think that what it has shown is that dramatically, the biggest thing that's uncovered for us is that we don't have the amount of people that want to work in schools, particularly during a pandemic, that it would take to operate and open as safely as we would like. In literally every category of job posting we have open right now, we're not getting enough applicants to fill those positions. So in a district where my board and really dramatically does want to open and has allowed me to spend whatever it takes to open safely, I cannot hire the staff necessary in order to do so in many cases.
Well, you got this email from Martha who says, my son is 42 years old and he and his wife are high school teachers in Florida. I'm terrified for both of them. Our schools have the option of in-person or online learning for the students, but not their teachers. Our governor has made no efforts to stop this virus, though he insists on opening our schools. Fully remote is what should be done under these circumstances. Martha, thanks for that email. Sarah, when we look across the country, are districts largely taking a science-based approach to reopening, or is something else driving the process?
I think districts are trying to weighing, you know, so many factors here. I'll let Dr. Beers decide on the science part of it. But I think, like, you know, this is really complicated. And one thing that I have heard from, you know, all of the pediatricians and epidemiologists that I've talked to is just that, you know, we have to expect that the things that are happening in our communities are also going to happen in our schools. We can't, you know, all of our best efforts, we can't necessarily wall off our schools from the rest of our communities. And so, you know, the really important thing is trying to, you know, reduce community spread so that kids can get back into schools in ways that also allow the schools to stay open. You know, I think one of the things we're seeing this week start up a little bit and last week was, you know, schools have to shut down for a day or a few days. And I think the question is going to be, you know, can these schools remain open in a way that is helpful for students and not disruptive with, like, continuous closures because of the caseloads?
Dr. Beers, what do you see when you look nationally? Do you feel like schools are making decisions that are based in those public health concerns that we've been talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think by and large, school systems really are trying to, right? I mean, we all have the same goal here, which is to get kids back to school safely. You know, and so I do think schools are, and school districts and teachers are trying to do that. I think, you know, they're unfortunately, some of it has become politicized. But I think those who are really on the ground making these decisions about getting kids back to school are trying to do so in a way that takes the science into account. I think, you know, again, getting back to the point of really having good communication and collaboration between schools and public health departments and pediatricians and other health providers is really important. And I think that's going to be really important both when making decisions about school reopening, but also making decisions, I think, as we point out, when inevitably there are positive cases or when there are increased rates of community spread. And so being able to make those real-time decisions together using the best science possible is going to be really important.
Superintendent Capozzi, you've been vocal about your frustration with this process of figuring out how best to reopen. And we also heard from a listener who texted, I'm a school board member in Pennsylvania. Nowhere in this conversation is the time, planning, and concern our superintendents, principals, and entire staff has spent preparing our schools to safely open. Talk a bit about the time and some of the frustration you experienced in trying to figure out how best to open your district.
Sure. Well, the frustration goes kind of back to the question that was just asked to the other two panelists, is are we as schools using science to drive our reopening plans? And what I say on behalf of lots of superintendents, and not that I speak for us universally because I certainly don't, is that we are not doctors. We are not health experts. And so when we are told to reopen safely and then we're not given guidelines as to what safe actually means, it's really difficult for us to use science in any degree to then reopen. So for instance, in Illinois, we are told to social distance as possible. So I can tell you that within a 40-mile geographic region of where I'm at, we are doing everything we can and adding staff to put 6 feet in between our students, particularly in the classrooms. And as a result, we're at a hybrid model. Whereas down the road, somebody said, well, it said as possible, so we're just going to do school. And so who's right, who's wrong in that situation? It becomes very difficult to point fingers or to say anyone's not using science or someone's using science when we are not getting direct guidance from those people that are in place to do so. So that's been the frustration that I've voiced. I would say that this, in terms of planning, that this is the hardest I've seen my team work any summer. And that's fine because a lot of people are working harder than they've ever worked before. But in terms of an actual thing that I think is tangible people can grasp is that we operate on a roughly $18 million budget. We spent $1 million trying to get ready. So we've spent over 5% of what our normal budget is, all while, since we're doing hybrid to try to promote safety, I get emails regularly asking for a refund on their property tax because that's how we're primarily funded in Illinois because their students aren't going to be in school every day. So there's a large disconnect between the understanding of what districts are trying to do to appropriately and safely reopen as opposed to the function of school as simply as childcare.
We're talking to Sarah Darville, National Editor for Chalkbeat, Dr. Lee Beers, President-elect of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and PJ Capozzi, Superintendent of a School District in Stillman Valley in Northern Illinois. We're also talking to you. Joel tweets, my family chose online instruction. I was bummed that my kid wouldn't get a teacher she knows, but then last week the school district went to online instruction, abandoning hybrid in-person teaching. I'm glad. COVID-19 is too contagious with the additional risk of asymptomatic spread. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and from our guests in a moment.
We're only months away from Election Day, and every week, or even every few hours, there's a new twist that could affect who will win the White House. To keep up with the latest, tune in to the NPR Politics Podcast every day to find out what happened and what it means for the election.
All around the country, schools are grappling with the question of how to reopen, and the answer is complicated. Our guests are Sarah Darville, National Editor for Chalkbeat, Dr. Lee Beers, President-elect of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and PJ Capozzi, Superintendent of a School District in Stillman Valley in Northern Illinois. Well, teachers, of course, are central to this debate, and here's what some of them had to say.
Hi, I'm Nick. I don't know whether or not it's right for us to go back to school in the fall or not. I am a teacher, but I do have a little trick. Watch Georgia. They've gone back to school, and some of the schools, according to the pictures I've seen, are not doing social distancing or masks. So in about 2 weeks, we're going to know whether or not it's safe to go back to school.
I'm Allison. I teach eighth grade English, and I've been pretty anxious, apprehensive about the opening of schools. Fortunately, my district recently changed their mind to full remotely, but we teachers are still expected to report in person to our work days, which is very confusing.
Hi, my name is Evan, and I am a middle school teacher, and so is my wife. And we are pregnant with our first child, and the prospect of going back to school in person is pretty spooky. And gosh, I want to go back to school, but it just seems it's so risky to have our families start that way.
Nick, Allison, Evan, thanks for leaving us those voicemails. I want to add this text. It says, I'm a high school teacher in Green Bay, Wisconsin. I'm 58 and had a heart surgery in my 40s. I'm healthy, but at risk if the virus affects my heart muscle. Our district school board has engaged the public in their decision to go virtual. The parents and community are up in arms. They believe teachers are copping out and that our union is somehow muscling the district so we can be lazy. The stress of seeing public commentary reverting to attacks on public schools school teachers have been demoralizing. You know, Sarah, there's been speculation about teachers' unions emerging as really powerful actors in this debate as educators are weighing whether or not they want to teach in person. What should we expect in the upcoming weeks from teachers?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think some of that remains to be seen. I mean, we certainly have seen, you know, the National Teachers Union sort of make comments saying, you know, we would support, you know, strikes in terms of around teacher safety and things like that. And what that actually means in practice, I think, remains really unclear. And certainly teachers nationally do are skeptical of returning to the classroom. But we also know and have seen teachers are returning. They're returning every day. So I think that's going to be one of the things we're watching really closely, as well as whether or just what remote learning looks like for when, you know, students and teachers aren't going back. I think that's really an even bigger question for all of us looking ahead to the fall, is whether or not the actual learning experience for students who are home is going to be better than it was in the spring.
Well, Superintendent Capozzi, many districts struggled with providing adequate virtual learning in the spring when schools closed the first time. How well prepared are you feeling going into the fall as you're employing this hybrid model?
Better prepared, for sure. What I think it's important to realize that when we went to remote learning, and I'm not just talking about our district, I'm talking about the kind of the profession at large, when most of the states decided to go to remote learning, we turned around a battleship, you know, mid departure. And so we went in my district in particular in 2 work days from normal face-to-face instruction to remote learning. And so the product was, I think everyone worked really hard, but I don't think the product was what we would hope to expect this coming year. And so we spent thousands of hours literally of training this summer to try to create a better product. That said, those that say that we should be in person because the product is going to be better are fundamentally correct. So the competing interest for us is the safety and health and wellness of our students, staff, and community, competing against the social-emotional well-being of our kids and the academic progress of our kids. And those two things are pulling in different directions. And that's what makes this so difficult.
Dr. Beers, we heard from Superintendent Capozzi about not getting access to the kind of guidance that he feels he really needs to know whether or not they're taking the right steps. Where is the breakdown in all of this?
Yeah, no, and it's so hard. And I think, you know, he's exactly right. And we're seeing this in communities and school districts. I personally have long been an advocate for better communication and collaboration between health and education. And I think some of the challenge, right, is that we haven't been always really good at doing this beforehand. And so right when we're turning that battleship, that's another thing that has to turn, and we have to figure out how to do together. I can't speak for every single school district across the country, but part of my role, I'm spending a lot of time listening to pediatricians and in hearing what's happening in their different states. And I think universally across our states and across our state chapters, we have pediatricians who really are standing at the ready, wanting and really eager to help with school systems. And so I think this is perhaps part of the additional innovation that needs to happen as we're adjusting to this new time, is innovating around how do we get health professionals and educators communicating and talking more readily. Because it is, you know, just I very much appreciate the comment that educators are not physicians, and I'm not an educator, right? And so the more we can be talking and working together, the better. And that's not something we've has been done terribly well across the board in the past, but hopefully this is an opportunity for the future as we look forward.
Sarah, as we move into the fall and more late summer, early fall, and more schools start to open, what will you be watching for?
I think the biggest thing is going to be, you know, what remote learning really looks like and what ways districts, you know, mobilize their resources to, you know, make up for the sort of lack of in-person connection and between, you know, teachers and students, and giving them those services that they really need. I think the other thing is, you know, we've been sort of talking about these decisions that school districts are making in like a little bit of a black and white way, but I think that it's really likely that districts are going to be making different decisions like many times over the course of the fall and changing as, you know, new information arises and they see how this all works. So I think like looking out for a lot more change ahead.
That's Sarah Darville, National Editor for Chalkbeat, Dr. Lee Beers, President-elect of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and Superintendent P.J. Capozzi. He oversees Meridian 223. That's a school district in Stillman Valley in northern Illinois. Thanks to you all. Let's switch gears now to talk to a school employee caught in the middle of this debate about how to reopen. Tammy LaPlante is a high school custodian in Ashtabula, Ohio, and secretary of the Ashtabula Association of Classified School Employees. Tammy, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So what's your school's plan for reopening?
It started as a hybrid version, and now we're at remote learning to be reevaluated in 4 weeks. So we'll start September 2nd, and we'll go to October 5th.
Well, your work, of course, can't be done from home. How does this conversation about whether or not to open schools impact you and your job?
Well, my job technically is like the lunchroom and all the specials classrooms, art, music, band, and that stuff. So other than the kitchen, everything else is still up in the air. We have no idea, you know, what that's going to look like. You know, we'll still be doing lunches that will be dispersed to children. But as far as teachers, we're still not sure. You know, they're supposed to be in the building, but that's still, something being discussed.
How have your colleagues at the school been affected?
Some are being laid off. A few are being brought back. Everybody's worried. This COVID has affected everybody, whether it's just unemployed or coming into buildings. It's just... And never mind the physical and emotional aspect of it.
And what are you hearing from your colleagues about going back into the school this fall? Do they feel safe? Do you feel safe?
Everybody has different levels of concerns. You know, we're just hoping to get the communication and the collaboration so that everybody's working together, because it's not just us being safe, it's the students, it's the community, it's everybody.
Well, the School Employee Association in your city has 162 members, and in May, 125 of them, bus drivers, teachers' aides, food service workers, received notice that they were being laid off. Why did so many workers lose their jobs?
The unknown, and without children or students being in the building, some of the services were done as, like, lunches were done, brought to various sites. So you didn't need all the staffing with that, the same as the bus drivers. You only needed a few bus drivers. And, like, paraprofessionals right now are being let go because they're saying they're not needed. And that concerns me because students need their services.
Do you know where your job stands right now? Are you at all concerned about that?
Oh, I'm very concerned. And my job will definitely change a lot, considering if my area is not being used, I'm sure going to be put in other areas of the building to help disinfect and clean, and as well as other people in the building.
What are some of your biggest concerns going into this school year, outside of just whether or not the jobs will still be there?
Just that everybody knows the right procedure to sanitize. That, you know, cleaning and sanitizing is two different procedures. And that we get the training that we need. And it's not just us, that if teachers are going to be helping at some point in the classroom later on, that they have that same training, so that we're all doing the same thing.
And at this point, are there plans in the works to provide you with that training, or is that just something you all are asking for?
It's something we're asking for, and we're hoping that it will be in place.
That's Tammy LaPlante, a high school custodian in Ashtabula, Ohio. Tammy, thank you for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you very much. Have a great day.
And we'll be talking about this all week in our series Homeworked here on 1A. Lots of you are chiming in. One of you texted, as much as I would like to see schools open, I think the safest thing to do would be to start out with remote learning for at least the first quarter. Constant reevaluation of the situation, along with input from medical professionals, would determine next steps on reopening. If schools open in person, what will happen when the first student or staff member tests positive? A member of the 1A Text Club says, my kids are in a language immersion program and they can't effectively learn the language without being in the language environment. There's no effective substitute for in-person learning in this situation. They're in a private school in Montgomery County, Maryland, which was ready to reopen but ended up choosing to go virtual. I'm very disappointed as my kids will suffer academically, not to mention the social-emotional impact. And Alexander emails us saying, I'm a rising senior in Stoughton, Virginia. I recently wrote a letter to the superintendents and school board members of my local school districts asking them to reconsider the plans they have in place. Currently, our schools are scheduled to begin August 18th on a blended learning plan where students go in person to school 2 days a week and learn virtually at home 3 days a week. We'll be hearing from all of you throughout this week during Homeworked. Today's producer was Haley Blassingame. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A,